Welcome, everyone, to our February seminar series. It is a great pleasure to welcome back Professor Scott Hagley from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He will talk about Christianity for a post-Christian context. It's a subject that I think we're all vitally interested in. Now, please join me in welcoming Professor Hagley.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you. I think the last time I was here was before the pandemic, and my memory is maybe not as good as it used to be. And so I parked where I remembered parking in the past, and I spent the next 15 minutes wandering around the building, trying to remember where I was supposed to be. Almost walked in on communion, I think, in the early service from the front, you know, opened the door, and there were, you know, obviously a place I wasn't supposed to be. Anyway, it's great to be back with you. Let me pray for us, and then we'll get started. Gracious God, we give thanks for this morning. We give thanks for the many gifts that you give, that you have not abandoned us or this world that you love. We give thanks that you are with us, that you are present here. Pray that you would guide our conversation this morning, that at least today, be looking at some things that might be challenging, taking note of changes in culture and society that have caused pain and grief in our churches, that we would also be aware and be cognizant of the gifts that you give, the ways that you sustain your church and your people. In Christ's name, amen. Okay. So the work that we're going to be doing over the next 4 weeks is part of a research project that I'm working on, which is a way of trying to take account of all the ways that changes in culture and society in the United States have shaped not just church attendance, but are inviting us in our churches to think about ourselves differently and to think about how we organize our churches and how we practice our faith differently. Part of my thesis through this whole thing is that we are in a moment that can look like a crisis, but that also invites us into a kind of opportunity, these are changes that are inviting the church to join in with the new thing that God is up to. So the arc of, you know, our 4 weeks are going to be 2 weeks on trying to name what's going on, and then 2 weeks on thinking about what might God be inviting us into. So if you leave today feeling very depressed and discouraged, I hope you won't, but hang with me. The book I'm working on, we've got four chapters of, you know, this, and then four chapters of where things might be going in the future. I want to start with a picture. Anybody know what this is? Okay, so if you were going to be walking into this building, let's say in 1975, you would have pushed through these large oak doors facing Liberty Avenue in Pittsburgh in the Lawrenceville neighborhood. And on any Sunday, it would have been full with worshipers. And this was a space that was built in the early 1900s by Irish Catholic immigrants to the Lawrenceville neighborhood. And at one point, it occupied an entire block in the Lawrenceville neighborhood with school and rectory and worship space. The sanctuary is cavernous with these giant kind of cedar, you know, arching beams, beautiful stained glass windows. And for decades, this was a center for a particular community in a particular neighborhood in Pittsburgh, where people were educated and where people worshiped. And where people were married and where they were buried. And it was a, you know, it was a centerpiece for the neighborhood. By now, you probably know what I'm talking about, right? Now, if you go there on a Friday night, you still push yourself through the same large oak doors coming in from Liberty Avenue. And it still has throngs of people and activity. And it is still a center of a kind of community in the Lawrenceville neighborhood. The problem, or the, not maybe not the problem, but the difference is on the left side, there's a long bar running the length of the sanctuary. And in the middle, there's a whole bunch of tables. And if you look towards the altar, you have giant tanks fermenting beer that are backlit with a little plaque next to it describing the fermenting process. It is still a place of the spirit, right? Just a different one. Or depending on your theology, and I'm going to argue that there is a kind of work of the spirit here, just happening outside of the church, happening in ways that might be surprising to us. So this is the church brewworks in the Lawrenceville neighborhood. And it can stand in for what's happening, not just in Pittsburgh, but in cities all across the country. The story of St. John the Baptist Catholic Church is that by the 80s, their worship numbers had dwindled, their buildings were falling, their whole complex was falling in disrepair. By the early 90s, the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh decided to consolidate, started what they're still doing and what many of our denominations are doing, consolidating congregations. They closed down St. John the Baptist Church. And then they sold the building in 1996 to a developer who turned it into this. And this is happening, you know, churches are becoming condos, they're becoming schools, they're becoming all kinds of things, but this kind of consolidation, this falling on hard times, you know, these buildings that were built for a different sort of era to house a different kind of role that the church played in society, are unable to stay open. And so as people's habits and participation in church changes, so also, you know, does the landscape of our cities. So this is a way of describing, you know, sometimes people will call this post-Christendom. And when what's at stake in a term like post-Christendom is this sense that the central cultural role that Christianity played in the United States, it no longer plays. And so we are post that sort of cultural reality. But people also describe something called post-Christian. It's a term that's been starting to be used more recently. And I wanna think a little bit more about that before telling you what that might mean. So it's hard to see exactly what these are about, but these are stats from, you know, different study, social, scientific kind of polls. And this data is all things that you are no doubt familiar with. And so I'm not gonna spend a ton of time on this, but like every time, you know, my news reader pops up with the latest data from the General Social Survey or from a Pew study or from the PPI, what's it, public, PRR, Public Religion Research Index, PRRI study, you know, the data is the same. It almost never changes. And it is, you know, if we look at the, just general study from the IARDA website, the blue line is Christians in the United States over time. The red line is those that check none on their, you know, that no religious affiliation. And then the bottom lines are Jews, Muslims, Buddhists that have largely remained the same in the United States from 1950 and projected into 2050. And so what are the two big things we see, right? Over time, the percentage of people that claim to be Christian has been in steady decline since, you know, the 1960s. And the numbers of people who check none on their religious surveys has been in steady increase. The largest, the fastest growing religious commitment in the United States is none. That stat has barely changed. Post-Trump in 2016, there was a slight rise in people claiming to be evangelical. But then when you look more closely at the numbers, they're using evangelical as a political signifier, not as a religious one, which is interesting. We can talk about that later. So this is the reality of the United States. So on the right is a Pew study that shows something similar to what we see from the YARDA website as well. So when we look more closely at the numbers, sometimes people are saying, well, you know, it's really only well-educated elites that are leaving the church, or it's really a phenomena in the Northeast and not in the South or the Midwest. But it's something that is primarily among the white population and not people of other racial or ethnic identities. Which all of this is somewhat true, right? So religious disaffiliation is higher in the Northeast and in the West Coast than it is in the middle of the country and in the South. It's higher among white folks than some other demographics in the population. What's interesting is it's religious disaffiliation is actually the highest among people without a college degree and white people without a college degree. And there's a sense in which those who still attend religious services tend to be better educated and tend to be wealthier than those who don't, which is a very interesting dynamic. And I think it maps onto the loneliness epidemic, the fact that, you know, I think it's like 23% of white men without a college degree can't name a single close friend, you know. So the kind of cultural fragmentation that's happening is also religious kind of fragmentation. But what this Pew study is showing, now this is a little bit old, this comes from just before the pandemic, but I haven't seen anything. I was just yesterday looking to see if Pew has updated this and they haven't. So my sense is these stats have probably not changed much, but the left side of the graph is changes in Christian identification. The right side of the graph is changes in unaffiliated identification from 2009 to 2018. And so you can see that for every category they have up there, men, women, the silent generation, baby boomers, Generation X, millennials, white, non-Hispanic, Black, non-Hispanic, Hispanic, less than college education, college graduate, Northeast, Midwest, South, West, Republican, Democrat, for every category, we see negative numbers, right? It's just different amounts, but all negative numbers, almost all close to two digits negative numbers, except for the silent generation and baby boomers, and then positive identification for unaffiliated, right? So it's not just that people are, you know, drifting from Christianity, but people are actively identifying sort of against Christianity in pretty large and sort of dramatic numbers. And then if we look at this by generation and by attendance, it helps us, you know, see things even a little bit more clearly. So this is also a Pew study that predates the pandemic, and these numbers have actually gotten worse since the pandemic. It's blurry and I apologize for that. But the bottom, the blue graph is what I want us to just see visually. So what it's doing is it's looking at Christians and it's asking Christians people that select for Christianity on these polls, how often do they attend church? And it's breaking it out based on generation. And so the heavy blue line is that they attend multiple times in the same month. All the way over to gray is that they never attend. So you can see kind of those, you know, you can see visually of those people sort of what that attendance looks like. For the silent generation, you know, it's almost 50% of the silent generation. If they say I'm a Christian, they attend church regularly, right? And then the other 50%, you know, gets broken down, as you can see, relatively equally. And then there's 12% that say I'm Christian, but I never attend church. And then for every generation after that, the number of regular attendees gets smaller, the number of nevers gets bigger, and then that, you know, middle ground trends towards less church attendance, right? The lighter colors are the larger colors. So the last line is millennials. 22% of millennials that say I'm a Christian attend church regularly. Think about that. So people that say I'm a Christian, this is very important to me, this is part of my identity, but you know, I get to church when I can. 22% of millennials who claim to be Christian never attend church. And I've got kids that are in college, I've got Gen Zers, it's even worse with Gen Z, right? So when we talk about post-Christendom, what we're talking about is, you know, changes in the cultural authority and the assumed role that Christianity plays in American institutions. You know, people don't wake up in the morning and say, my life's a mess, maybe I should go to church, right? They wake up in the morning and they say, my life's a mess, maybe I should go to yoga today, or maybe I should call my therapist, or maybe I should join a running club, right? None of these are bad things, right? These are not bad things, but there's a different role that Christianity plays in relationship to culture and society. I was a pastor in Vancouver, Canada for 8 years. And in a place like Vancouver that never really had a Christendom, right? Never really had never really played the kind of central role it played in a place like Pittsburgh. You know, they would do these studies of kind of the authority, you know, where people would go turn for religious authority. In my neighborhood in Vancouver, 3% of the population would go to a religious authority figure if they had religious questions. Think about that. 3%. 3 out of 10. That's 30%. 0.3 out of 10. 3 out of 100. If they said, I have a religious question, would say, maybe I should go to a priest. Maybe I should go to a rabbi. I experienced this. I was a hockey coach. I grew up playing hockey. It was important to me. My kids learned how to skate. So when they were old enough, you know, we put them in hockey, and then I coached. And my co-coach was a woman that lived close to us, and she became a good friend of our family. And she knew I was a pastor, and she kind of, it was this kind of like mystery thing, like this like black box, like what is this about? And so one day at Easter, she was like, Easter's kind of a big deal for you guys, right? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, kind of one of the main things. And she's like, well, could we come, you know, her and her daughter, Sydney, could we come to worship on Easter Sunday? I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. So we had a plan. She came to church with us. Her daughter came as well. That was also playing on the team with my kids. And we were going to go have dinner afterwards. And so we're sitting in worship, and I'm, you know, kind of wondering how has she experienced this. We leave worship, and she was like, that was amazing. She's like, there was like the singing, and there was like the speaking, and there was like, I mean, like there was so much. It was great. So much stuff. She's like, that had to take a ton of time to plan. I'm like, yeah, you know, that's what I get paid for. And then she says, so when do you do that again? And I like had to think, like, what do you mean? When do we do that? Like, I mean, that's a lot of planning. Like, when do you do it again? I'm like, next week. And she was like, you do that every week? I mean, so this is kind of the reality, right? So we are entering an era like what had already been existing in Vancouver, right? Which is that assumption of some kind of relationship to centrality of the church and ecclesial institutions is it's not there. There's other places of authority, right? Other places where people are going for religious they're taking their religious questions, their religious longings, other places. You know, and you can go to a Steelers game and see there is still plenty of religious fervor in Pittsburgh. It's just in a different kind of cathedral, right? So that's post-Christendom. What I mean by post-Christian is what's seen in some of these other surveys that say, even among people in our congregations, how we think about our relationship to the faith and to the church, and the church as an institution in particular, is changing, such that even when we look out in the sanctuary, how people are relating to the faith is different than it used to be. And some of the basic claims of the church are increasingly implausible to our younger cohorts, right? So I'm a Gen Xer, and you know, among my generation, it's a lot more common to navigate my own relationship to the Christian faith in ways that make sense to me. And so I'm going to borrow this from this part of the faith that I like, and I'm going to borrow this from Buddhism, and I'm going to borrow this from self-help, you know, books or whatever, and kind of craft my own relationship to the historic Christian faith, and then also navigate my own relationship to the church as an institution. This is even more true for millennials, even more true for Gen Zers. And so by saying post-Christian, I'm trying to name a challenge that even exists among those that are already gathered. We are relating to one another and to the church and to the faith in new kind of ways. In ways that are, as the sociologist Ulrich Beck would say, individualized ways. Individualization as one of the primary modes of modernity in Western societies, meaning my identity is my own life project, and your identity is your own life project. There's a sociologist, Zygmunt Bauman, that uses the metaphor of liquid modernity. You know, modern life is like being afloat in a boat on a sea of possible options of meaning making, and it's my job to navigate my own path through all of the things, a little bit from the church, a little bit from TikTok, a little bit from here, and trying to, and identity is my own project, and identity is your own project. So inside our churches, these are also kind of, you know, realities. And so this is, I think, what we're getting at when we talk about post-Christian. I'm wondering if we could, is it, I wasn't prepared for people on Zoom. Can people on Zoom, they can put stuff in the chat, right?
Yes, and if people on Zoom have questions, they can unmute themselves and
okay.
Pipe up.
Great.
But so, just invite them if you want.
I'd love for people to sort of turn toward one another and say, how does all of this strike you? How have you seen these realities present, you know, in your church or in your own life? And what kinds of questions does this raise for you? So let's maybe spend 2 or 3 minutes just kind of checking in, and then we'll move on. Okay.
With the decline
and on Zoom, chat among yourselves.
Among yourselves, okay.
Okay, let's 30 seconds or so, and then we'll come back into the large group. Okay, let's go ahead and return to the large group. I'm wondering, I guess we got a microphone coming around. I'm running any observations about what I shared or questions that emerge for you that might be helpful to share with the large group?
Speak right up.
Got one right.
I guess I'm wondering if what you've given us is a snapshot or a moving picture. And if it's a moving picture, it's moving in a certain direction, and it doesn't sound favorable for organized religion. So if that's the case, is there some way of changing the trajectory, which is narrower and narrower and narrower, to becoming enlarged? And that would mean the organized churches would have to change in some way to be different.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you've basically like robbed all my thunder for the next 3 weeks. Yeah, it's definitely a moving picture, and the trends are continuing along the lines of what's come before, in the sense that I think a lot of our church institutions for the last 20 or 30 years have really operated under the assumption that, like, if we just kind of fix this or that, we can kind of hang on, you know, we just need contemporary worship, or we just need to have like coffee in the narthex, or, you know, we just need a better children's ministry. We need a younger pastor with young kids, or, you know, whatever. And those are all kind of like technical fixes to what is really an adaptive challenge or an adaptive problem, which is the culture and society has changed. We are in some sense built for a society that no longer exists, right? So I think you're absolutely right. It's moving in a particular kind of direction. Now, I want to sort of back off from that just a little bit to say, you know, as someone that studies mission, is interested primarily in like local mission, and by local mission, I mean, what does it mean for the church to bear witness to the good news of the gospel right here and right now? I mean, that's the kind of question that I want to ask. And I think like if we put that question against the larger kind of history of Christian mission, history of how churches in different times and in different places have made sense of the gospel and made sense of where they are, that the church has always been in a different kind of moving environment and has always, you know, how the church has thought about itself in relationship to culture and society has changed all throughout history. And so we're just in one of those kinds of moments. So I think the question of how do we go back to something is the wrong question. I think the better question is, what is God up to right now? And what will it look like for us to join in with that? Which means that there's going to be some things in culture and society that we as a church are going to say, no, actually, we offer an alternative to what is the predominant cultural norm in this way. But there's going to be other things that we're going to say, you know what? We are going to join in with this cultural norm or this cultural practice, even though we used to not, because this is something we think God is up to. And so I think that kind of like this active discernment and risk-taking and experimentation is what, you know, this moment calls for. But that means operating differently, you know, in pretty profound ways. I don't know if that helps.
So John Michael online says, certainly I've seen these tendencies and it makes me wonder what God has in store for the church, which is kind of consistent with what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so, you know, like I said, today, next week, we're going to kind of try to name some of the reasons for why we are where we are. And then the last two, we're going to think a lot more about what a faithful response looks like, or at least the outline of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is Dan Paul.
Go ahead, Dan.
My son is a Presbyterian pastor, and he showed me a study that showed that only a very small percentage of Christian churches are healthy. And of course, that's just a manifestation of these big trends you talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff there around that. You know, when they do this thing called the National Congregation Study, the last one, I can't remember the year the last one came out. There was one in 2019. I'm trying to think if there's one after that. But what the National Congregation Study keeps showing is that the large churches are getting larger and the small churches are getting smaller. So if you just look at the overall numbers, you know, the average church is declining by, you know, every 5 or 10 years or whatever. It declines by like 5 to 10 members or whatever. So now the average church size is like 75 or 70 or something like that, or the average congregation size. But if you look underneath the numbers, what you're seeing is, you know, the number of church attendees is continuing to drop. And the number of churches is continuing to drop. And so what you end up with is a few very large churches that keep getting larger, and then a bunch of smaller churches that keep getting smaller. So like the average small church size is like 25 or something like that, right? And then the average large church size is, you know, in the high, you know, the hundreds into the thousands kind of thing. And so, so when you think about that and that in relationship to the church ecosystem, you know, a little bit of like the Walmart Main Street, you know, is happening. And you think about who are large churches built for, right? Are they built for thinking about building dynamic connections with the nuances of particular communities in a society or in a neighborhood? Or are they built to sort of create a kind of I don't want to say consumer experience because that sounds judgmental, but like a niche experience for different markets of people, which is really sort of how they're structured. And so I don't want to say that that's unhealthy or healthy. I just kind of want to observe that this is, we're putting a lot of eggs in sort of one basket, right? And so I have questions about that. Places where Christianity seems to be having a lot of energy is in networked groups of Pentecostals that don't really belong to congregations at all, but sort of self-organize based around where they live and the Pentecostal kind of national profile preacher that they happen to receive their authority from. And so you've got these kind of centralized Pentecostal ministries that have great, you know, huge music ministry, huge preaching ministry, and then they kind of fan out through the internet all over the globe, and people will kind of self-organize, and they never actually belong to a congregation, but they consider themselves a Christian. They consider themselves under the teaching authority of this Pentecostal, you know, apostle or pastor or whatever, and they might like show up to the ER in Orange County. This is actually a true story, and start healing people in the ER. Saying you don't need to go to the doctor, but they're not a part of a congregation. No one told them to go to the ER in Orange County. They just showed up there because, you know, then you've got this hyper-individualized form of Christianity that's not even connected to congregations, which is also a kind of growing movement in the United States. The health, non-health binary is an interesting one, but as soon as we get underneath that, it becomes also very interesting and raises for me a lot of questions. Yeah. For
that
the Pentecostal. So the names of this. So the book that traces this is called The Rise of Network Christianity. Can't think of the author's names right now. It's about a 5-year-old book published by Oxford University Press. One that you might be familiar with would be like the Bethel Music. You know, a lot of our churches that do contemporary worship songs. My guess is in your contemporary worship service, they might even sing some Bethel Music songs. They have a huge music ministry. That would be one of these organizations. International House of Prayer out of Kansas City is another one of these organizations. I can't think of the names of like the people because I don't really follow this, but it's just kind of a movement I'm aware of.
Is that what IHOP stands for?
That is, yeah, actually, yeah. True story, yeah. I mean, they do call themselves IHOP. It's a, yeah. Okay, I'm gonna move on. What I wanna do is to now begin trying to understand how did we get here? And I'm gonna give 4 images over the course of this week and next week to kind of give us a metaphor to kind of hang this story on, to connect this story to. The first image is soil. The second image is water. The third image, oh, I'm blanking on the next week's images. Soil, water. Third image is air. And the fourth image is home or shelter. Soil, water, air, and shelter. And now these are all things that are required for life, right? All things that are required for an organism, for a human, for plants, for animals to survive, right? We all depend on soil, water, air, and some kind of shelter. And I want us to think about American Christianity as having a distinct kind of relationship to the soil of America, a distinct kind of relationship to water, to the life springs of life in America, a distinct kind of relationship to the air that we breathe and to the shelters that we've constructed. And what has happened is the Christianity that we've inherited in the United States has developed a particular kind of relationship to all of these necessary parts of life. And also, all of those necessary dimensions of life have been in flux in pretty dramatic ways. And so I think by naming it this way, it's helping us to understand how we got here, but also it gives us a hint at how we might navigate our relationship to the soil we depend upon, the air that we breathe, the water that will give us life, and the shelters that we might construct, right? Okay, so let me dive into the first one, the soil. The soil of that American Christianity has taken root in has always been a shallow kind of soil. There's a book by Mark Knoll, a historian of U.S. Christianity, called The Old Religion in the New World. I think that's a great way of thinking about U.S. Christianity and particularly Protestantism in the United States. So our churches, the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran Church, the Episcopal Church, even the Methodist Church, they came to the United States from the European continent. And the assumptions, the ecclesial assumptions that they depended upon, that they brought over from Europe, were very quickly disestablished, were very quickly messed with. Because what happened in the settling of the United States is we were not the colonial project of just one European country, right? There was a kind of, we did have the English colonies, but the French were competing on U.S. soil. And you had different immigrant groups that were also coming over very early on and bringing with them their religious practices. And even in the English settlements, you had different sects of English Protestantism bringing their own, you know, religious practice. So the Puritans and others, right? And so you have in the United States a tangle and a mix of different Christian groups living side by side with one another alongside indigenous peoples, right? Alongside enslaved people brought from Africa and Catholic indentured servants brought from Ireland and other kinds of things, right? So you have this religious complexity almost immediately in U.S. soil that was just different from a land-based, nationality-based, state-based understanding of religious practice in Europe. To be Christian was to be European, and even more specifically, to be English was to be Anglican, right? To be German was to be Lutheran. To be French was to be Catholic. And that all gets messed with on U.S. soil. And so it was the obvious thing to happen, you know, when the Constitution was being written in order to hold all these groups together was religious disestablishment. That the state was not going to choose religious winners and losers. That the church was not going to be the beneficiary of the state's largesse. And so the disestablishment of religion that happens shortly after the War of Independence creates a lot of anxiety, as you can imagine, among pastors at that time. So Lyman Beecher, who becomes known later in his life as a proponent of voluntary associations and religious competition, has a very famous sermon in the early 1800s decrying the disestablishment of the Congregationalist Church in the state of Connecticut, where he was a pastor at the time, and saying that this is the beginning of a vile hour for America, and the people are gonna, you know, that the moral, he predicts moral disaster for America because of this injustice, this terrible thing that the state of Connecticut is doing. And about 10 years later, he's a champion for religious disestablishment because he realized all these creative energies that were unleashed by disconnecting the church from the state. But we should just notice that this disestablishment of the church creates a new kind of environment for our different traditions. It makes us think about church differently, and it makes us behave differently in relationship to where we are. And so there's a book called The Churching of America by two sociologists of religion, Roger Finke and Rodney Stark. And what they look at is sort of what happens after disestablishment is what we create a competitive religious economy. And so the churches are left to compete with one another for adherence, which, you know, kind of was happening in Europe, but it was happening through wars of religion after the Reformation, right? Protestant nations fighting Catholic nations for the soul of Europe. In the United States, it wasn't happening through armies or through governments. It was happening through revivalists and pastors and pamphleteers and all other kinds of things, that if we were going to survive as a church or as a congregation, we needed to attract more adherents than the other guy down the street. Because if we were going to survive, we needed people attending who were willing to open their wallets and give money to the functioning of our churches so that we could, you know, build buildings and run programs and pay pastors and all of the things. And if we didn't have enough people in the pews, we couldn't survive. And so the same kind of raucous competition and institution building that was happening in other parts of the United States in the 19th century was also happening in our church systems. And so Finke and Stark say this competitive religious economy unleashes all kinds of entrepreneurship. And the churches and institutions who try to control the chaos actually decline in numbers. And the churches and institutions that lean into the chaos, that say, we're gonna stand on our head and we're gonna, you know, do all these new things and we're gonna preach in the language that the people understand and we're gonna, you know, have services, you know, outside of the city in tents and do revivals. These were the groups that were growing. And the Episcopals and the Congregationalists at some level, the Presbyterians and the Lutherans that were saying, no, we want to control this. We want to be orderly like we were in Europe. They lost out to the United Methodists. And then when the United Methodists started to want to become a little bit more orderly and create seminaries and make sure pastors had education before they pastored, they started to lose out to the Southern Baptists. And then when the Southern Baptists start to say, well, maybe our pastors should go to seminaries and maybe we should be a little bit more orderly and be a little bit more organized, they lose out to the Mormons, right? That this has been the cycle, rise and fall of different groups, the groups that lean into the entrepreneurship, the groups that lean into the chaos of a competitive religious economy tend to do better than those that try to keep it staid and stable and steady and all that kind of stuff. You know, as a seminary professor, I find this very disconfirming. Finke and Stark make this big deal that the Methodists start to decline the year that they start requiring ordination, the kind of ordination requirements. Like, okay, message received. But Finke and Stark point to a couple of different things. Like, so what is it that made it possible for what characterized the successful churches in the United States? flexible organizations with a national strategy, charismatic clergy that came from among the people, energetic, otherworldly, and simple messaging. An interesting part of their research is that when churches try to diminish the otherworldly dimensions of their message is also a mark of decline. So the more we try to say, hey, you know, we're just kind of baptizing kind of, you know, elite norms and kind of status, you know, with a little bit of Christian language, that actually doesn't help churches grow. What helps churches grow is emphasizing that we are offering something otherworldly, something that can't be offered anywhere else. So that explains, you know, their theory has been really helpful in explaining the rise of Pentecostalism, for example, in the United States, right? The new measures and well-planned revivals, and then those that leaned into competition, that those that sought a competitive advantage actually gained the competitive advantage. So I don't, let me give I'll come back to what I was going to say. So they say, they kind of conclude this part of the book saying, how did the upstart sects win America? So they're talking here about the United Methodists and then later the Southern Baptists. How did they win America? Partly by default. As free market conditions increasingly prevailed in the religious economy, the old mainline denominations failed to meet the competitive challenges and eventually abandoned the marketplace to the upstarts. Comfortable, well-paid mainline clergy, educated in seminaries, rarely desired to go west and had no taste for ministering to the ignoble vulgus. They earned more esteem from publishing their sermons in books than from bellowing them to multitudes in open fields. In any case, clergy flirting with Unitarianism would have been little worth out where the great harvest of souls was underway, even had they been willing to venture forth. Moreover, clergy accustomed to gentlemen's agreements limiting competition were ill-equipped to hold their own in a free market. I don't mean to suggest that this is all good for the church or good for Christianity, right? Just because something is growing doesn't mean that God's hand is upon it. But what I do want to note is that these market conditions are the very soil in which all of our churches have been planted, right? There's something new and unique and a little bit odd about Christianity in America compared to Christianity in other parts of the Western world. And that has to do with these market conditions and the ways the church has in some ways thrived in the United States. We are consistently the outlier among other Western nations in terms of church attendance, church kind of vitality, entrepreneurship, and these kinds of things. But these soil conditions have also made it so that the roots don't always go very deep. And so as quickly as an organization can grow, it can then also crash. And what we're living through right now is a kind of crash, right? And there isn't a lot for us to go back to because we are one competitive player in a marketplace of competitive, you know, organizations and ideas by which people might make sense of their lives and build community and things like that. So we've benefited from that, but we can also be harmed by that in terms of our organizations. There's a second. I think I'm off. I'm not able to switch here. Ted, I think I'm on the wrong screen. There we go. So there's a second. So there's the legal disestablishment that I think created the second kind of layer. When we look at the stats, churches really start to decline in the 1960s in the United States. And I think like there's a lot of reasons for that. I'm not going to get into all those, but we can just maybe sum that up to say that there was a kind of cultural disestablishment that started kind of post-World War I, but really sort of takes hold in the United States in the 1960s. And this is a series of changes in American society that have made us more suspicious of any authority figure and any institution, the church included. And so I don't mean to say things like the sexual revolution, that's why no one's going to church. But the sexual revolution was a challenge to a particular kind of authority structure, right? That we have not really acclimatized ourselves to still in the church. And then you can think about other kinds of revolutions, kind of post-1960s as well. So, and one of the biggest dimensions of that, I'm having trouble switching again. There we go. One of the biggest dimensions of that would be changes to how we, ways in which the church has become, the white mainline church we've become more conscious culturally about how the white mainline church has become entangled in white supremacy. And I'm going to talk more about that next week. Part of the cultural disestablishment is the disestablishment of a kind of white paternalistic structure. And that it's not disestablishing fast enough, but that has created, a kind of crisis, I think, in our mainline churches as well. So Robert P. Jones, in his book, The End of White Christian America, described it this way: for most of the nation's life, white Christian America was big enough, cohesive enough, and influential enough to pull off the illusion that it was the cultural pivot around which the country turned, at least for those living safely within its confines. But this artifice weakened as white Christian America shrank in size and the power of its institutions dwindled. And so we have a legal disestablishment that had created the conditions for this competitive religious economy, but we've also experienced subsequent cultural disestablishments in which things the church could rely upon for its own authority and its power have also been questioned around race, around sex and sexuality and some other things as well. So the second image, I'm realizing time, I'm going to keep us moving here. The second image then is water. And this is closely related to the first. So how the church learned how to thrive in the shallow soil of disestablishment was by creating and sustaining massive networks of volunteers. So volunteerism became the primary mode of church organization. And so without state coffers, without state support, without a close identity between being, German is the same thing as being Lutheran is the same thing as being German. The operating assumption was each of us gets to choose our religious participation. And so we will, survive and thrive as a church if we can attract and maintain large numbers of volunteers, people willing to give their money, willing to give their time, willing to, kind of give part of their life to the functioning of this organization. You had a question for a second?
I want to go back to the prior discussion. My understanding is that the Constitution did not disestablish religion, it de-established it, which is a big difference. It's saying that religion would not be a part of the civil government. It's too big.
Yeah.
It can't be a part of it. So it de-established it.
Yeah.
So that there is ultimate freedom of religion. But yeah. It did not in any way disestablishment.
Yeah,
that's my understanding.
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm going to trust the lawyer on this one. That's helpful. I mean, it's popularly called the disestablishment clause, but I think you're right. And I think the intention was to actually protect religion from state interference, not necessarily to say we shouldn't have religion at all. Thank you for that. So one of the changes that has happened is the voluntary structures, the voluntary practices and habits that have made our churches go have been changing very dramatically post-1960. And so part of what we're experiencing, not just that we're built, that we have shallow roots and shallow soil through disestablishment or de-establishment, but also the water source that made it possible for us to flourish in this environment, that tap has been turned off. And so, when we think back to the Pew study that shows, millennial Christians will attend you know, only 22% will attend church regularly, that that is a massive blow to how we do church, right? We cannot function as congregations the way we are currently structured as voluntary organizations if, you know, only, you know, 10% of our people attend regularly, or 10% of our people give of their, you know, tithes and offerings, right? We can't function without that. And that is, you know, so our water source, our source of life, based on the assumption that most Americans want to volunteer, that they can volunteer, that they have money that they want to give, that we depend upon that. And that has changed dramatically. Question.
Where does the concept that the state has taken over a lot of the roles that volunteer roles that the church used to with the Great Society, and then you go on from there, so that the state is doing things that the groups and churches and communities used to do?
Yeah. Yeah. That is that what?
People volunteer by what people used to volunteer for.
Yeah, perhaps. I think I'm thinking about this in a slightly different way, but what you, your question makes me think about the fact that in the 19th century, Mark Knoll, in his book, America's God, has a section where he talks about the massive kind of voluntary energies of churches in the United States in the early to mid 19th century, so the early to mid 1800s. And, you know, I think during this time, that was something like he takes 1 year, and I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but you'll get the sense, where like the US government had $3.5 million given towards kind of like, you know, food programs and anti-poverty kinds of things. And voluntary associations, church-run voluntary associations, did like $18.5 million worth of work, right? So like it was churches and voluntary associations that were doing the primary work of sort of kind of mending the social safety net and things like that. So I mean, I think that's a little bit of what you're referencing. I think like, but I think if we think back to like kind of Great Society legislation in the 1960s, or we even go back to, Roosevelt, you know, New Deal, you know, stuff. Churches helped weave some order and support, but there were still a lot of people falling through the cracks, right? So I don't know if the binary totally holds up, like the government's doing what churches used to do. I mean, there was just a lot of need that, you know, that was created by lack of a social safety net and a competitive kind of economy that rewards some and punishes others. But I do think what we've noticed since 1960 is rates of volunteerism. This is not just a problem with churches. This is a problem actually with anyone that depends upon volunteers. So something has changed culturally and socially that we are in some ways the victims of. The assumption used to be that it was churches that made Americans such great volunteers. We stand out among the Western countries with our levels of social and civic and cultural engagement. Americans are, if nothing else, if not volunteerers. And what we've learned since the 1960s is actually the churches benefited from volunteering. And we sure, we trained people on how to be good volunteers, but we were also dependent upon other kinds of cultural phenomena, other kinds of cultural forces that made people more likely to volunteer when they were on American soil than they were at other places. And that has now changed. There's a ton of theories as to why this is. I'm trying to change the thing again, and this will be my last slide because we're out of time. So there's a lot of theories as to why this is. Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone, is one of the people who talks a lot about this. But we don't actually really know why that is. Changes in family structure, with two people working all the time, changes in our economy that make it necessary for families to have two workers, changes in family structure that make single parent families more common than they used to be. You know, that all obviously depends upon it. Putnam thinks actually TV has something to do with it. Part of his theory is before movies, Americans volunteered better. Once cities got movie theaters in the early 1900s, volunteer rates dropped. And then they really drop after 1950, after most homes have a TV in their house. We think about now with the internet and having a supercomputer in our pocket. So Putnam's theory is a little bit like we used to volunteer because we were bored. nobody really knows, but what we do know is that volunteering creates a vicious or a virtuous circle. More volunteering begets more volunteering. Less volunteering begets less volunteering. And we are now in a vicious circle rather than the previous virtuous circle. And so this big question of how do we build social capital, I think is a political question for us, but it's also a question for our churches. How do we build social capital? How do we help people figure out that participating and volunteering and engaging in these communities and building communities of faith, people face-to-face and religious communities is still something worthwhile? That's, I think, a huge question for us. Okay, so I'm gonna pause there. I'm happy to talk afterwards, but soil and water, shallow soil, and then our life source, that tap has been turned off. And I think that explains part of what we're experiencing right now. And we'll get to the other two next week. All right. Have a great rest of your day. It's good to be with you all. And sorry for the abrupt ending, but we'll pick it up next week. Thanks.